Blackwater, The Wagner Group, Executive Outcomes, The Flying Tigers, The Swiss Guard, The White Company, The Knights Templar, The Varangian Guard, Clercus of Sparta, Pythagoras the Spartan, Mentor of Rhodes, Socrates of Achaea. The list is endless. Mercenaries, guns for hire, soldiers of fortune, private military companies, private security contractors, dirty deeds done not so dirt cheap. History is replete with privatized militaries. Call them what you want. They have been around for a very long time, and they are very likely not going away anytime soon. And like it or not, wars are good, very good, for business. Furthermore, history tells us that more people are enslaved and killed by such means as greed, corruption, oppression, and tyranny than by any other means. So choose the red pill, remove your blinders, all of them, and take a good sensory inventory of what you're being told and shown to believe. Because here we go. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Okonis, The Contractor's Life. Talking from the relatively insular and bucolic rural foothills of northwestern Washington State, I'm your host, Scott Dresser. Life as a private security contractor in a hostile or a war-torn zone, or, as some call it, an austere or a non-permissive environment. Well, it is a mixed bag of blessings. Some good and some not so good. All in all, though, private security contracting is much the same as life. It is what you make it. The MENA region, or the Middle East, North Africa region. Lands of enchantment, lands of mystery, lands of the old ones and the ancient ones. Myths, legends, folklore, maybe. If you believe what you read in the ancient and the holy texts, then you know that it all centered around what we refer to as the MENA region. That's right, the Mediterranean. And you probably also know that to every legend or myth, there is a base of at least some truth.
All right, folks, that's it. Welcome to an excellent episode of The Contractor's Life. I've got a guest, a return guest. He and I worked together, and we've kept in touch over the years. His name is Greg Hesch. He's a veteran of the United States Air Force. He's a paramedic, and from what I gather, and from what I remember, a very good one, too. He's a private security contractor and a project consultant. Again, it's Greg Hesch. Greg, welcome.
Thank you so much. How have you been?
You know, I don't know how to quite answer that one. Somewhere between I've been better and, you know, at least I'm standing vertical above ground.
Amen to that. Amen you know? To that.
You know, so you've been on this. I want to look. I think looking back, you've been. This is going to be your fourth time here.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's always been great. And so before we launch into this, why don't you go ahead for the people that are listening? Just give them whatever pressy or bio or background information on you that gets you to where we're at now.
All right. Well, that's an interesting question there. Well, started out with just a youthful lust for adventure and excitement in life. I didn't see myself doing the standard track and becoming an accountant or anything like that. So very young in youth, I was attracted towards emergency medicine and pursued that through various means as a young teenager in ski patrol and search and rescue and stuff like that. Then came time for graduation, had to make some life decisions. One of those decisions was if I go to college, I'm just going to party my life away. So I ought to do something productive. And that's when I decided to go into the military. Initially, I tried to get into the Navy as a corpsman, but being from my small hometown of Los Alamos, New Mexico, all they could see is Nuke Submariner. And I was like, nope, don't want to do that. So decided to go into the Air Force track and thought about it because it was more of a cerebral operation than some other forces out there, and just thought it'd be a great track. So I did it. Was quickly kind of disenchanted by the regular route of the Air Force. So that's when I pursued the specialty in combat search and rescue, and did some training. Had a slight injury that held me up for a while, but eventually became part of a forward control team that was attached to the Rapid Deployment Force. And it was a very interesting job. Very disjointed as far as the regular career path of, I guess, an airman, because I was part of the Rapid Deployment Force, and that meant get up and go at the moment's notice. And you never knew where you were going or quite what you were doing. And a lot of that still is, very hush-hush and blah, blah, blah. And so we don't get into much detail there. But afterwards, got out and tried my hand at civilian medicine as a paramedic, became a critical care paramedic and flight medic. Also maintained my connection with combat medicine, teaching and helping develop the footprint, if you will, for tactical medicine in law enforcement and fire departments, jointing these two together. In my military service, I was part of JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, which was the follow-on to Desert Eagle and the mishap they had through communications of Special Operations Group. So JSOC was developed to bring everyone together, communicating as special operation groups. Nowadays, it's pretty seamless. I mean, most operations that have multiple facets from Marine Corps, Army, Air Force, and Navy have joint tactical command people that are very familiar with everyone's operation. So we've kind of got on the same page finally. After I played civilian medicine for a while, was flying a lot, doing flight medicine. 9/11 happened. Wanted to go right away, but had a young family, and my ex-wife, or the wife at the time, was not very kosher to me running off and playing soldier. But as the years wore on, by 2009, she had heard enough humping and grumping and all this stuff. And she also was attracted by the paycheck. And I was attracted by the paycheck. And I said, listen, we could do a lot with the money. Unfortunately, she ended up with a good chunk of that in the divorce. But that's a different story. That's a sad combat story. And, went over to Iraq, and that's where we met, out at CSE Cedar and doing force protection. Great group of people. Very interesting the diversity that we had out there, because we had people that had actually deployed before and had been in combat areas and had been in Desert Storm and a whole myriad of stuff. And then we had a lot of people that were absorbed from law enforcement communities. And that was interesting to bring them up to military expectation, because I think sometimes it got a little confusing. And as the days went on in Iraq, it even became more confusing as SOFA took place and we gave Iraq their authority back. And it was about that time that I switched over from being a remote medical officer in a fob to a PSD medic. So I was on a protective service detail for a very unique group out of Baghdad that had some pretty big assets that we were driving around the place. So connected to the State Department at that point, and very interesting. A different, more the style of medicine that I was used to. You know, on the roll, quick, things develop quickly, have to be diffused, thinking on your feet, that type stuff. And after that, you know, it was a unique experience. Looked great on the resume, had all that remote medical officer, blah, 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 this, that, the thing. Got out and actually participated in some contract developments for some people. Had several big projects. Of course, you know that as a contractor, that there's always another project, you know. And worked on several of them as a consultant, did some pretty cool things. And then just kind of settled back and enjoyed the peacetime. Afghanistan was not really looking for contractors per se anymore. They pretty much just wanted to maintain a military presence that was rather unique in the contracting there. The money went down and the contracts became kind of confusing and a little thin, I would say. You know, that's where we find me today, sitting here. You know, have a huge background in medicine, 46 years.
Wow.
And yeah.
I got to
So.
ask you, in terms of medicine, one thing, because I saw that the term changed a little bit. Because one of the field medicines, and I'm using it probably in the incorrect nomenclature, but so you can clarify and articulate this. But one of the things that I found really fascinating in terms of, because here in America, everybody talks about first aid CPR. And it's like, well, okay, that's fine. I mean, that's, probably the first thing that most doctors do, something similar to it anyway, when they're, scoping the person out, but then they go into deeper stuff. But I guess where I'm going is that the one that I was exposed to that I found absolutely fascinating, and of course, I can't go into detail, but I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, in the WPS thing, that the T triple C, or the Tactical Combat Casualty Care. Okay. So I read something here recently that they changed one or two of those words, and it's called something different. How would you, in terms of a security professional, a contractor, military person, how would you rate what T triple C was or what it is now? How would you rate that in terms of, say, an average knuckle dragger having those skills? Would you say, yeah, that's a great thing? Or, I mean, how do you view it?
Well, when it was T triple C, I think they may have had just a little too much information that they were trying to train people to. And I think the hybrid of that over time, the value of the lessons actually deployed that save lives had become compressed. And so all of a sudden, we start looking at things like, you know, airway is our least concern at some point, which is completely heresy, you know, 20 years ago, 15, 10 years ago, you know, to say, well, airway can wait because what I've got to do is plug the holes. I got to whip on some tourniquets. I need to plug the holes, and then we can worry about bringing everything else up. So I think as far as knuckle dragging and the low-lying fruit of the military sometimes, I think it's a great course, to be
Okay.
honest. I really do. And the reason being is because it has effectively increased survival times on the battlefield. There's just no two ways about it. You know, with the advent of body armor, we and Kevlar helmets, we have minimized a lot of the combat injury that was life-taking. And now we have a lot of limb injury that if we can control and turn off the plumbing to it, we definitely can get people off the combat field and into a medical aid station, forward line type stuff, patch them up even more, and then stabilize them to the point that they're on a aircraft going back to, you know, Ramstein or wherever they're going for their treatment. So it's made a world of difference, huge difference.
How would you compare that, or is there a comparison to the other one that, a lot of guys talked about back then, the Combat Lifesaver course?
It's kind of the same thing. You know, the Combat Lifesaver course was one of those things that we taught tourniquets and stuff like that. We didn't teach a lot of hemological packing of wounds and stuff back at that point because it was still considered too aggressive in the field, I guess, which is stupid. It only became accepted practice when people started doing it and saying this saves lives. And, you know, the progression of medicine in the military is really interesting. And I'm blessed. I have a good friend of mine, Colonel Dirk Wassner, who was one of the lead trauma surgeons at Fort Bragg in North Carolina at the Special Forces Training School. And so it was so refreshing to have someone that says, you guys need to embrace the skills of what we're doing in the forward aid station surgically, and quit trying to do things like just hold pressure on it. Holding pressure on it ain't going to work. I can tell you that. I've watched more people slip from under my hands because we weren't doing things in my time of practice of taking hemolytic gauze and just shoving it in there, packing the wound, pressure dressing it, tourniquet, turn the entire wound off, get them to the surgical site, forward surgical site. And they're like, shit, you know, all we're going to do here is hydrate them a little more, look at anything real serious, maybe intubate them and get them out. And we're going to fly them to the regional trauma and surgical centers. So in its progression, I think it's a logical progression. But I think also now we see that they're also paring it back, which is a common thing we see in emergency medicine practice. You know, when I first went in and I was working in cardiology, they had us learn everything about life, advanced cardiac life support. Oh, my God, we used to have to figure out bicarb deficits and all this other crap and all these lengthy calculations for dopamine and all this other stuff, and blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden it changed. And all of a sudden it was just like, you know, most of the things that we need to do is just make sure the heart's beating and maintain a pressure. We can do that with epinephrine and a few other drugs. And wow, it simplified. So you see the same transition happening now. You'll have your
epinephrine. Are you talking about like the EpiPen? That kind of thing?
No. This is a cardiac epinephrine.
Okay.
Yeah, not the EpiPen. An EpiPen's a different ratio. Okay. That's 1 to 1,000, and we're using a 1 to 10,000 in cardiac medicine, which is, you know, you can work with both of them, but you have to know what you're doing because you have to be able to knock it down to cardiac strength. Leastwise, you're going to blow that person's heart right out of their chest. But
the overdose, the overdose.
Oh, my friend, let me tell you, we've been on both sides of that street. And I remember back, I think it was in the 90s, we were doing high dose epinephrine in the field for cardiac arrest. And I had a good friend of mine, Dr. Billowitz, who was my medical director. And he was hilarious. He said, well, I mean, you know, we could give a spare tire enough epinephrine, we could get a heartbeat in it. And I was like, yeah, that's probably true. So he's just like, yeah, there's a point where it just doesn't make sense. But anyway, to answer your question, Scott, it started out with, I think, some basic information that we thought would be very useful to the combatant, the regular troop on the field. And now we have taken that and we have pared down what was useless and maintained what was critical and increased on one side, you know, the wound care and the blood loss control, the hemostatic control, and then all the other stuff took a lower progression to it. Okay. And it's so funny because even in civilian life, they've done this. Hmm. It used to be, remember you used to go to your CPR course, it was the ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation.
Yeah.
Well, now it's changed 180 degrees. It's CAB, circulation, airway, breathing. Because of the military, because of what we do in the field, and they're saying, if you're not controlling exsanguination, the bleeding, if you're not controlling that, doesn't matter how good you're ventilating, doesn't matter how good your compressions are, doesn't matter that you're ventilating them perfectly, they're going to die because they need juice. And we got to make sure that they don't leak their juice all over the ground. So by controlling the bleeding first, we have saved innumerable lives. And still, you know, there was a lot of crazy stuff we used to do. Sulfa powder and put a wound on it, hold this. You're dying. How are you going to hold enough compressive pressure to provide hemostasis to a bleeding vessel? You're not. So it's progressed nicely, I would say.
Okay. So on that, then, for let's say the security guy or gal here in America that's required to go get first aid CPR, would you say that's a good first step, or would you say that it's evolved to a point where that's probably all you need?
No, I would say first aid CPR, and then I would recommend some kind of combat life support course. And nowadays, the combat life support courses that are out there, especially through Gunsight and a couple other of the big hitters, some of the training agencies and stuff out there, they understand this well because it's combat proven. And once things are combat proven, that's really the litmus test for a huge part of our medical practice today, especially in the surgical arena. You know, there's always other branches that take you a different road, but trauma surgery in a whole has never really changed. It's advanced. We definitely know things about, you know, rapid infusion and being very precautious with that. And now keeping them in a hemostatic range where they're having perfusion, but we're not blowing clots out, you know. We're saying, yeah, let's keep them in this range right here of survivability within their blood pressure and circulation. And you can maintain that for quite some time. It's not necessarily optimal for the human body, but it's at a point where it increases your survivability.
So would you say that EMTs and paramedics that we frequently see in what I'll just call ambulances, would you say that they're that what they receive now in terms of instruction and training is better or just evolved?
I would say it's evolved. I don't know that it's any better because you really don't see this skill set. Be honest with you, in most of the classes today, you do not see the combat type skill set in there. That's going to be taught in the tactical combat care type courses, courses that you seek out specifically for that information. Not that it can't be applied in the civilian world, but the one thing unique about the civilian world is we're not removing them from one theater into the next. Our travel times, when I was working for the city of Pittsburgh, we were lucky if we had a ambulance ride that was over 10 minutes. You know, that's how close you are facility to facility. You'd get dispatched, you'd go there, pick them up, 10, 15 minute ride, you're at the back door of an emergency room. You're still well within that concept of that golden hour. You know, the golden hour begins at time of injury, and survivability has been shown that if you can address trauma within that golden hour concept, huge survivability. I mean, you're talking 80% and higher probably. That being said, in the combat realm, you have to consider extraction time.
Right.
And that's why assets have trained so hard and so dearly to decrease time of injury to time of surgery. That's a huge thing. And that's what all the air assets train for, is how to minimize that.
So in a combat scenario, then that would, you know, for say a blue, you know, just a layman kind of thing would be like, so that now we're talking only number of bases where they would, where these helicopters would take off and land from, but also where they're located in proximity to wherever the combat is at. So the generals, the admirals, whoever, and whoever else is involved in it, got to say, okay, well, we thought we need this many, but we need this many more, and they need to be in these locations. I mean, there's a lot of that goes into it, right?
Right. Sure is nowadays.
You know, well,
there's been
some
ass kicking missions out there that literally, for lack of a better term, bitch slap some people into reality.
I gotta ask you, because there's another guy I know, and I don't know if you know him, but he did a little contracting overseas because he was a paramedic fire guy and rose to the ranks. But he and I were at one point, we actually argued about it, but you know, I said, well, I'm just going based on what the documents here at the state level indicate, that there were three, I forget the exact term, but basically three trauma level hospitals in the state of Washington. And he was, and I forget what it was, he said he was part of the advisory board that went through this whole thing. Long story short, he claims that there is, that it might still be out there in the wild, that it lists three or four of them, but he said there's only one, and it's in Seattle, Washington. And I said, why do you have only one level one trauma center in an entire state? That doesn't make any, and he went through the whole thing about, you know, flight times and one thing and another. And I'm thinking, to me, that just didn't make any sense.
Well, let me shed some light on that. The reason it doesn't make any sense is because it's based off of financial. It doesn't make any sense. I think there should be more than one regional trauma center in the state. Many states just have one. The reason being is because trauma is a huge money loser. You recoup very little on trauma because based on the outcomes, you're having a huge expenditure of assets and money and resources go out to someone who stands a minimal chance of living. Therefore, the benefit is one of those things that kind of outweighs itself in the end. So trauma centers lose money. And I know that from working in trauma centers and being involved in the conversations there. You know, everyone likes the praise of being a level one trauma center. But the problem with the level one trauma center is you have to maintain all specialty services in-house 24 hours a day. So that means you have to have someone on MRI. You have to have someone in CAT scan 24 hours. You have to have a group of surgeons in-house ready to go. You have to have an OR staff ready to go, all that stuff. And it can't be on call. That's a level two. If you have people assets on call and you have a certain structured time, then you qualify as level two. So level one says you must maintain a full deck of cards in-house 24/7. And that's really tough when it comes to things like neurosurgeons.
I'll bet.
So, and they're going, all right, you want to pay me for 24 hours on call as a neurosurgeon? Well, hell yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the reason I brought that up is, in addition to other things, because I mean, it does, you know, when we look around and people are constantly talking about whether at the corporate level or the government level, you know, they want money for this and money for that program and this. And it's like, well, what about, well, we talk about the bare core services that we used to provide 20 years ago, 30 years ago that we thought were important, you know, kind of like where in the community I live, it used to be a big logging community. Not so much anymore. I mean, we still got them. You still see the trucks going up and down with the remains of the trees. But I mean, you know, if you're 10 or 15 miles into the woods, and you get bashed up pretty good, you get all mangled, and you got no trauma place to go to, I mean, you could probably have the world's best paramedic, but is that going to be enough?
No. You know, you could have the world's best paramedic, you know, but if you don't have certain things like bright lights and cold steel, you're not going to resolve the issue.
Hmm.
You know, blood loss is blood loss. And to counter blood loss, you need to give blood, whole blood.
Hmm.
And that blood has to be compatible with the individual receiving it. So you're going to have a blood bank. Maintaining a blood bank, we had a couple flight services that did it. Very difficult to do. Hmm. Have to have an incredible relationship with United Blood Services. Because all that stuff has to be logged every 12 hours as far as its time, date, stock number, blah, 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 the temperature range that it's maintained at, all this stuff. And then it has an expiration date on it. So it's not like something that you're going to hold on to for a long time. I forget how long they're actually active preservatives in it, but how long they last. I don't think it's more than 2 weeks. Okay. I think that after 2 weeks, you have to discard it. Without that service in place, it goes back to the same thing that was happening in you know, the Korean War and stuff. They saw the survivability go up enormously when they employed helicopters in the Korean War to recover combat injuries and bring them to the forward surgical, or not the, yeah, I guess frontline surgical. It would be aid station surgical at that point. So they get them to aid stage surgical, they get them in there, and those surgeons can do amazing things, you know. Mm-hmm. They pop in there, they can tie vessels off, they can, pack wounds in a certain way, do hemostatic, which means control blood control procedures, you know, and then ship them on to the next place where they can reassess and examine the extent of the injury and then start the phase of surgeries, because a lot of the combat injuries don't just have one phase of surgery. I would say most combat injuries out there that can't be handled completely by a forward aid station have at least 2 to 3 stages of surgery. You have the forward stage, and that forward stage can be special operator medics going in there and tying stuff off, getting in there, clamping stuff, packing that wound, having those surgical clamps in place, having a field ligation on an artery, tying it off, and then moving that to a forward surgical. They get up to the surgical, they look at that artery and say, okay, we can graft artery on that, we can do this, that, and the other thing, but do we want to do that here, or do we want to do it at the tertiary care facilities, the care facilities that are going to take them from stage 1, 2, 3, 4, and then discharge usually back stateside to Bethesda for recovery or stuff. Those are things that have to be looked at. And nowadays in the military, that's exactly how they're set up. Wow. You know, when we were in Afghanistan, they had their forward surgical hospitals, but then they had the big hospital, and I think it was Jalalabad, that they were handling a lot of those cases. And then they'd go on the aircraft and be flown either stateside or wherever they were depositing them at that time. Usually Ramstein. Ramstein was a big intermediary hospital. Every operation has that, or at least has contingencies built into it for that forward movement of a patient.
So I got to ask a question, because I can't help but think. So why is it, in your opinion, if you have a formulated opinion on it, why is it that, for example, in the military, especially if they know they're potentially going to have to go to this hostile area, or they're already there, why is it that they're willing to spend the resources to make sure that they have what you're talking about in place, but when you come back stateside and you're here in this country, we're not worried about it. I mean, why don't we have the resources for the same thing?
Oh my God!
I'm just saying.
Beautiful question. That's a beautiful question.
You know.
There again, I think it comes down to the money game, my friend, which is an ugly thing to say. But I think a lot of times what you see in the civilian world is the feasibility of financial recovery from stuff.
Mm.
You know, how are we going to be able to recuperate this? How's this going to happen? And there's, don't get me wrong, they're obligated to work on anyone. It's just that the follow-on care is not like it is in the military when we have one of our servicemen injured.
Okay.
When we have our servicemen injured, I mean, it steps up. And we know that because it's great. It's fantastic until your follow-on care and they go, well, go to the VA and try to make it a
Well, I was just gonna bring that up because when you talk about follow-on care, I mean, I talked to a number of guys that, you know, they, you know, once in a while you'll hear a story where in the state where they're at, that particular VA center does a pretty good job. But for the most part, I wouldn't call them horror stories, but they're just completely disillusioned with the VA system, you know. And I understand that we're talking private hospitals, you know, they're privately funded. But I mean, if medical care is such a big deal and they pushed it so hard earlier this century about health care for everybody and insurance and everybody else tells us that we're important, that we matter. I'm just saying, why can't we come up with the funding to have true trauma relief medical centers? Because, you know, when we're overseas, when we're outside, when we're in those areas, I mean, once you've been exposed to that stuff, I mean, even if you weren't that person's friend, you the environment you're in and all the stuff that you're exposed to, you want to get that person fixed, and it's all hands on deck. But you come home and it's kind of like nobody cares. Nobody even wants to get out of the way of the ambulance.
Right, right.
You know?
Two different worlds. the world of a combatant on the battlefield, you have everyone. You have every single asset, every one of his brothers, sisters pulling for him in one direction. You know, let's get you safely to where you need to go to get this fixed. you know, when we get back home, I think you have to look at it that, I guess for a lack of a better way of putting it, and I know there's probably, if there's any physicians or cardiologists out there, they're going to frown at me because they're going to be going, oh, he's letting out the secrets. It all comes down to financial recuperation.
Yeah.
And they look at that and things have a tendency to be more commercialized in medicine. You know, I recently, what was it? August 18th. I think it was August 18th of 2022, I finally retired from medicine because of that exact thing. Hmm. I was working in the cardiac cath lab up here or down here in Florida as an interventional cardiac technologist. So I'm working, you know, passing wires into your vessels and help placing stents and opening occlusions and all kinds of things. And I'm working directly with the cardiology group. And I have never met more entitled people that had egos that were completely opposite of that what was once taught in medical school.
Mm.
These were egos that had more concern over things like, what's my bottom line going to be? How many patients can I get in today so that we're maintaining profitability? Because the group that I work for, we're looking at our numbers. Da, da, da. And you hear all this pornographic talk about money and weighing money versus healthcare and compassion. And the two don't mix. The thing that was unique about being a combatant overseas is that everyone's pulling your direction. There is no consideration for what's this going to cost.
Right.
consideration is let's get them out of here. Let's try to do something to save them. Once you get back here and you go to the VA and stuff, you soon find out it's that balancing act again. It's one of those things where unless you have a good relationship with your primary provider and they have some respect for what you've done in the military and stuff, well, then they'll push and pull strings for you. But if you're one of those people that end up with just a hands-off or laissez-faire type of physician that is there to punch a time clock, well, then you're at a complete deficit, because you're not being served correctly as it should be. And it's a sad thing with the medical machine today, because it is definitely turned into a financial game, if you will, for lack of a better term, because they sure have sacrificed a lot of compassion and understanding. Right. And I don't want to say that everyone's like that, because I've worked with a group of physicians, specifically emergency room physicians, trauma surgeons. Man, they don't care about anything other than saving someone's life and being compassionate and understanding. But there's a lot of other people out there that are looking at, my greens fees for next year at Pebble Beach, and stuff like that. And it's like,
right.
Wrong attitude to take.
Well, let me ask you then, kind of a similar vein. So in your experiences as a contractor, so when you got out of the military and you went overseas, did you see a differentiation between the way that people pulled for a military person versus did they seem to have the same vested interest in helping a contractor?
Oh my God, that's a great question. These are hardcore questions because they require honesty.
Well, I guess I'm asking that because there's so much out there in the wild that people just truly don't understand about being out in the wild.
Yeah, that's very true. Let me tell you this, because this is, gospel right here. Having been that guy that was having to provide high level quality care for my guys out in the field with zero acknowledgement from the U.S. military that we even existed. But what I have found is that the military understands the contractor mindset. There are a lot of people in the military that once they have an opportunity to talk and visit with you, have a tendency to almost glorify you, because it's like, whoa, wait a minute. You figured out a way to do this streamlined? You guys got, this great rules of engagement. You've got minimal overview and you're out here doing your job. But as far as we can tell, there's not a big machine sitting over your head bearing down on you like the average soldier and grunt. And it's true. It's like, yeah, you have a lot of autonomy, but with freedom comes responsibility. And so a lot of times I saw that where contractors were just looked at as an anomaly. They're like, how are we going to justify, throwing you in a surgical arena out here and stuff? And it's just one of those things that you look at. And I can only tell you through experience, the way I addressed it is, first of all, being savvy about the military medical complex and just the military structure and how to deal with people, because I had to do it in austere environments before. And that's that you form these relationships and you get to talking to these folks, specifically the physician group. The nurses and stuff, they're always in awe of a contractor because they're just like, whoa, you rogue warriors, and shadow warriors. It's like, yeah, kind of to a degree, but understand, there's a minimal group of that, but we all wear the same shoes. But the physicians were the ones that I found interesting because I had to literally explain to several of my providers out in Iraq that, hey, this is my situation. I've got these 800 Ugandans out here, or these, you know, 15 Ugandans out here, or these, you know, depending on what FOB I was on. And I needed to have some degree of cooperation with you. However, I can offer you this as well. I can offer you my skill set during times of crisis. And the minute you do that, and they look at you and they go, you would step up? And it's like, dude, we're in this all together. I'm no more than another set of hands in your operating room, or, you know, another guy dropping a tube in someone, or putting a chest tube in, you know, all that stuff. And once you have that relationship with them, and there's some validation through them. And I found the best validation, for at least my experience, was to invite some of the docs out shooting. You know, when we're out there having, they point to the Connex box and they say that has to be empty by the time you go home. And we're like, oh shit, that's a lot of rounds. I always used to invite, you know, the PA, the doc, or someone out and say, hey, you know, you want to go shoot a PKM, a AK-47, you know, take your sidearm out and give your AF-92 a little rattle. And they were always pleased by it. And once you establish that core communications and they validate you as being someone that the guy knows his shit and he's out there to keep his people alive, that's where it changes. And all of a sudden, that's where doors opened up. You know, I always go back to this one story, and I'll spare you the full length of it and stuff, but we're up at JSS McHenry up in Hawija. Absolute abscess on the butt of the world. They hated us up there. Saddam's home area. So we were very disliked up there. And, you know, Fridays were like anywhere else in Iraq. Minaret goes off for a little bit, la, 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 evening prayers, praying for accuracy. And of course, they're going to launch a couple rounds your way. Boom, 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 boom. And we're sitting out there, and I had a very good, fully tabbed Ranger PA that I'd been working with and spent a lot of time on the range with him, had a lot of great conversations, had the understanding that when shit goes south, I will be in here and I will help you dust these people off, and we'll just like clockwork, you know, because we've got the set of assets that are the same mindset going out, in, out, in, out, in, out, in, out. And that's what's important. And then he takes off. We say our goodbyes and stuff. His replacement's coming in. I meet his replacement, who's supposed to be a surgeon, coming in from United States, and steps off the aircraft. And first of all, notice that she's female. I think she was a major, if I'm not mistaken. And we had her over to the cookout that night. And we get a couple rounds coming in, and CRAM's going off, wing, 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 all that. We're sitting there flipping steaks, smoking cigars, and watching and listening to rounds land in the field off in the distance. Boom, boom, boom. She's mortified. She's just white as a ghost, just doing the looking for the shelter thing. And we're kind of staring at her. And I asked her, I said, so, I said, how did you come up to end up here? I mean, this is, you know, kind of an austere base up here. We're up here in the middle of nowhere. And she just looked at me. She says, I have no idea. She says, I have no idea how I ended up here. And that took me by surprise. And I was like, well, trauma surgery or general surgery? What? She says, no, I'm a pediatric oncologist. I treat children's cancer. And my eyes popped, and I was just like, well, what in the Sam Hill are they thinking sending you up here? I mean, shit can happen here in a heartbeat. It can happen 10 minutes from now. We could be overrun, you know? And had the conversation with her that evening. I said, because she was, I could see the fear in her eyes of, oh, my God, I don't know where I am and what I'm going to do. And I said, listen, I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I'm an old hand at this. I've done plenty of mass casualty evacuations in the combat area. I know how to get aircraft in, nine line them, get them out, and just we'll make this happen like clockwork. Anything happens here, you'll look like a hero walking out of here. And she was like, really, you would do that? I said, yeah. I said, under one condition, I need to have full access to your pharmacy for my guys. So all the antibiotics and all the antivirals, all the pain meds, everything that I need to take care of my guys, I need to have access and be able to have that ability for my guys. And she was like, well, hell yes. So that's what I mean about the meshing, you know, you've got to mesh with it. And I've seen some contractors go out there, especially medics that go out there, like, you know, they're the lone gun in town and screw themselves because they don't establish that line. You got to go in there and, you know, the long beard like you has does great things for that, especially when it's got the this beautiful silver tint to it. And you go in there and then they look at you and they go, well, you're a man of a couple of years. And you go, yeah, well. And they're like, what the hell are you doing? Oh, I'm a contractor. No. Military contractor. Hired gun? Yeah, hired gun. And they're like, holy shit. What's an old fart like you doing? Well, be careful of an old man in a young man's game. Just remember that, you know. And it opened up a lot of doors. It established a lot of really good relationships.
I'll bet it did. You know, that's interesting. I won't make this long at all, but I mean, I remember a number of those kinds of things where, you know, as a contractor working with the military, especially at certain special bases, but, and had a conversation with one guy not too long ago here where, you know, that if they're a military person and they've not been a contractor, they've always been in the military. I mean, they're going to hear things about contractors that a lot of other people hear. And being human, they're going to have whatever preconcepts they have about it when they meet you. But the conversation I had with this one guy, an SF guy, he was on a camp. And I remember because I drove by there and tried to visit a few times there in the Bagram area. Okay. And but he was talking about, and as the time went on, we saw more and more of this where contractors thought they were someone special and walk around with a big ego and a big air and, you know, like, hey, I'm a contractor, I'm a civilian, and you're just, you know, it's kind of, so I guess where I'm going is that humility thing. I mean, you don't have to be meek and mild, but just if you can exude a little air of humility and listen and observe, and just get along with people, basically what you're talking about happens. I mean, they will tone it down and they will come around to, all right, you know, he does his job, let him do it, you know, and you can perform some beautiful things together.
You know, you said a gold mine there, because that goes for any asset in contracting. You know, I've worked with a lot of hired gun type contractors that were ex-Marine that went out there thinking that I'm a hired gun, you know, I'm a mercenary. And it's just like, put your spurs in the box, dude, settle down. And what they're looking for in our profession as a contractor, and I tell this to anyone interested in contracting, is number one, hubris. Go in there not thinking that you're the biggest swinging dong in the area.
Right.
You're not, you know. Go in there with hubris, because you're working with people that are adamant professionals. That means you have to be an adamant professional. Don't go in there thinking that you're going to tear up the bars, you know, shoot your gun off in the middle of the streets and jingle your spurs in the saloon, because you're not. If you do, boom, you're out of there. Right. They don't want that liability. They don't want that kind of asset that's going to be a liability through your stupidity and lack of self-control.
Right.
What they're looking for specifically are adamant professionals, people of enough maturity within the job line that they know how to act with respect, a degree of humility and outward respect and calmness,
right,
decompression of situations versus escalation.
Right.
You can have the crowd coming at you, hollering and blah, 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 blah. You drop down to a knee and start aiming on them and shit, it's going to go south.
Yeah.
You get up there, you take your stance, you give them a position of ready, but hands up, talking to them, da-da-da, bring your elder over here, bring your spokesman. I don't want to talk to 50 of you. Bring the one guy here. We'll have a conversation. And when they see that type of composure, especially in theaters like Afghanistan and Iraq, where if you know the cultural norms in addressing these people and you don't come off like I'm the big hammer, but you do stupid little things like, how is your health? How is your family's health? How are your sons? You know, how is your wealth? And you ask them these questions that are doing with everything else other than what you're talking to. You know, in Afghanistan, especially in the Pashto culture, there are 12 different levels of greeting that you should go to before you ever get to discussing business. And if you do it correctly and you, I don't want to necessarily embrace their culture, but respect their culture at the same time as exuding from you a sense of authority and responsibility, they'll respect that quickly. They'll respect that very quickly, and they'll be more apt to communicate to you. They used to do that a lot with me because I had the tendency of bringing it down, then you'd ask them the offset question. And it wouldn't be about, you know, well, do you know any weapons caches in this? It's like, hey, you know, how are you? How is your health? Oh, you're Haji Doc. How is your health? How's your family's health? Is everyone doing okay? Is there anything that anyone needs medicine-wise that I can help you with? And and you go through this layer, and then all of a sudden it comes to, now, we're here, and we're looking for weapons caches, and we're looking for this, or we're looking for information on this. And once that degree of trust is there and they see that you're not there just to bully them around and thump your chest, then doors start to open up. Right. And then they begin, especially, and I learned this through the culture out there, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, is if you actually treat someone of their family, then it opens up huge, 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 huge doors. I had a little kid that was burned out there one time, and I was in Baghdad at the time. But he had been brought in from someplace else, and they couldn't get him into the hospital for some reason, or blah, blah, blah. And he had been burned with grease. He'd been a big thing of grease, and he'd scalded a high percentage of body surface area. And so I was concerned about it. I was like, yeah, what I need you to do is go ahead and come bring him back here tomorrow. I'll dress him. I'll put Silvadine and dressed him up and had him all bandaged, and he was feeling much better. gave him a little something for pain relief, a little oral medicine, and said, just, you know, a couple of these an hour, every 6 to 12 hours, whatever, and he'll be fine and stuff. And had him come back 2 or 3 days just to monitor that it wasn't getting infected and all this great stuff. And I tell you what, that entire group of Bedouins became one of our largest assets as far as, oh, hey, you know, there might be some trucks moving through that have some stuff on it you might be interested in. And I'm like, well, I don't know.
Right.
And how would you know this?
Yeah. You know, so, well, that's funny, because I liken that to just having a normal conversation with people that we would otherwise consider to be a criminal or a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, and oddly enough, I've seen this happen a great number of times, but one in particular was in a southern border state a couple of years ago where I was doing a security gig, and just having, you know, I mean, you know, I'm doing my usual cognizant awareness thing, you know, and scrutinizing everything, but I'm doing it with a smile on my face, you know, or at least a straight face at the very least, right? And if somebody asked me a question or started talking to me, I would talk to them and try to have a normal conversation. You know, of course, I got to pay attention to what I'm doing, but where I'm going with it is that I developed a relationship with one guy who was a pretty big deal in the criminal organization stuff there. And he came around a number of times just to say hi and shoot the shit, see how things are going. And remarkably, never had any real problems there. He saw to it. He may. I didn't realize that until the day I was leaving when he came in, because I left on a Monday. And then so Sunday he shows up and he is dressed to the nines, just came back from church. And he just wanted to say hi and talk to his friend. And I said, I'll be there in a minute. And a couple minutes later, I went out. But in the meantime, somebody that looked really unsavory was trying to come in and he stopped him. And it was, he made it pretty clear. You're not, you know, turn around, get out of here. You know, I'm just saying that, you know, so I guess I'm just hearkening to what you're saying that, you know, it's not the only experience I've had, but I you know, you see that, you know, guys in the security industry, we see so much of it that they make the matter worse because of the way that you respond to somebody.
Right. I think a lot of times people forget that this is a cerebral game, that it's not a game of force. You can go in there and try to force someone in to do something, and you're going to end up with resentment and animosity, which is going to work against you. You can go in there and try to understand someone, befriend them, do them a kindness of some kind, and all of a sudden there's a different view upon you.
Yep.
That doesn't always work. I've been in scenarios where there are people that are adamant shitheads and will take advantage of that and try to play with that and stuff. But there again, cerebral.
Right.
You start picking up on those things, those micro inequities, those little nuances in your communication, and you start feeling that, yeah, you know, I'm getting a jerk here.
Yeah.
That works on your part too, because then you start withholding some of your stuff and they're onto it. They're like,
right.
You're not quite as frank and open as you were yesterday. How about that? Because you're not being frank and open with me.
Right.
And so it is, it's a chess game. It really is. And it's so funny because even in a medical position and as a contractor, you see this. And I think it's funny sometimes because you see the older, experienced military assets understand this. It's the young lieutenants that you've got to watch out for that go in there and they think that that bar on their collar holds some degree of authority over people in a village or something like that. And it's like, you know what, sir, best thing you could do is just shut up.
Right.
Just shut up and maybe let us do some talking and establish some things first. And I always find it's usually the enlisted guy. It's usually the staff sergeant, the master sergeant, you know, somewhere in those senior ranks that have been dealing with just shithead recruits the whole time, know how to talk to someone, know how to snap a knot in their ass at the same time that they're giving them an attaboy pack, you know? So it's like, okay, and you see that, and it's an art form. It really is.
Yeah.
Truly art form.
Well, but it harkens to, you know, just that whole, what you call the cerebral part of it. I mean, there is a time, you know, you got to get kinetic about it, you know, but for the most part, you can stave off a lot of that just by dealing with these people in a certain manner.
Sure can.
You know, I mean, I won't go into detail about it because I've talked about it before, but like, for example, I don't know if you were around, but when you were in that Baghdad area and you were on that team you were talking about, you and another guy we know came through a couple times at least when I was working there. And I don't know if you remember or if you were there when we had that strike by the African Guard Force. Okay. So as I recollect talking with other people there on the camp at various, you know, departments and agencies, the guys that I was in charge of on that one ECP area were the only guys that didn't really strike. They were the ones that showed up.
Right. Well, we had a handful of our cadre, you know, when they were going to do their general strike that would, because we've already in our minds conscripted with these guys.
Hmm.
We are in line with what their mission and their belief and their objectives of the mission is. And it was through that loyalty that followed them through their assignment there.
Right.
Those were the people that we turned to and said, okay, you're a person of integrity. and a person that can be trusted to lead. And after that whole rigmarole was dealt with and we launched a bunch of people home, and those that stayed, they figured it out real quick.
Yeah.
Because they learned from their own people that this will not be tolerated.
Right.
Will not be tolerated.
Right.
There's one individual, I don't know if you remember him. Do you remember Kevin Luswata?
Kevin, what's the last name?
Luswata.
Well, I knew a couple of Kevins, but I don't remember the last name.
Young guy, probably 22 at the time he was out there, 22, 23. Very muscular, very driven, motivated individual, still that way, very cerebral guy, very thoughtful. And his big thing is he wanted really to become a U.S. Marine. He just thought that was everything. And after the strike, he was one of the guys that held tight and held his position and did his duty. And he was promoted after that into a position, I think, of sergeant major or something like that. And I remember one day that he was addressing his guard detail and stuff, and someone smarted off or said something, and in a true Ugandan child warrior fashion, went over there and grabbed this guy by his collarbone. I mean, yeah!
Wow.
Snapped a knot in that guy's ass so quickly. Everyone saw that. And that was the one statement that those Ugandans needed to know that that is a serious man. That is someone not to challenge. That is someone not to sit there and think that you're going to try to pull the Ugandan bro thing with. And it was just one of those things. And we had a handful of those guys
right.
that were our leaders at various places. That was phenomenal.
Right.
Because you could trust them.
Right. Well, and that reminds me. So I think you mentioned the base, but down there in that southern Iraq region where you and I met, we had a couple of the senior leaders there for the African guys. And two of them just happened to be Bushmasters. They had.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I will say that what I learned there, I took with me to Baghdad, and it worked. It's kind of like, as long as you can demonstrate through your deeds and your actions that you're willing to get your hands dirty and stay up all night and all day if you have to get the things done, and that you're fair, you're mostly impartial, you just do your job kind of thing, eventually they will come around to you. But the reason I mentioned that is that that there was an incident where I had to go back to the B dock at one time, and the sergeant that was with me, that was one of the African guys, we had to go back and check out a couple of rifles to go back and resolve a matter, which we did. Took him back, and that big, tall, swarthy dude that was a Bushmaster, he asked me what was going on. I told him. That guy took control of it, and I've never seen a guy tremble like a leaf on a tree like this dude did. Whatever he was saying to him in that language got him to understand, don't do that. You know,
yeah, probably something to the extent with, I will eat your children and grandchildren.
I don't know, but it worked. And I was like, you know, and he shook my hand, you know how they do, how they cross one hand and they shake with the other one. That's but so I guess what I'm trying to say, you know, because I tell people this all the time, you know, there's good people and bad people in every culture, every country, every whatever. You know, and for the most part, you know, as long, I mean, you got to be alert, you got to pay attention, but as long as you're otherwise, if they sense that you're a good meaning person, you'd be amazed at what they would be willing to do to help you out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had the same thing when I was in Beirut, you know, as I was transiting through stuff, you know, I was there for a week, and I had probably one of the very few private civilians at the time, he was ex-army, as my private chauffeur, and he was armed, and he took me through some dangerous places just because he wanted to show me around. And he said, don't worry, as long as I'm with you. But I'm just, those are the kinds of things I'm talking about, you know, and guys that I've met that went out of the way to go with me all the way to the airport, through the airport. It's like, I don't need this. I've done this many times, but they wanted to make sure that I got where I was, from where I was going to where I'm going, safely. I'm just saying, you know, same thing at BIOP. I had people help me out with stuff. I mean, it just, you know what I'm saying? If you're just a good person, you'd be amazed at who's going to come out and help you.
Right. Well, that's how it works.
It
You
is.
know, that's why I say adamant professionalism, adamant professionalism. You go out there as a professional, you conduct yourself as a professional, on duty, off duty. It has to be that way because you're under the scope 24/7 by everyone out there.
Yep.
And then hubris, going in there with, like you said, that touch of humility, that hubris that says, I'm here also to learn, do my duty, do it well, but learn and be open-minded to other people's suggestions.
Yep.
And that's huge. That's very.
Well, my friend, we're coming up on the end of this. I got to ask you, is there anything else you would like to say as a last thought or last thoughts as we wrap this up? This has been a great discussion, and I want to have you back again, and I think we will be back again. But
I'd love to be back. This is always a treat for me. You know, I think, Scott, the only thing that I think I'll leave you and me with is that we are entering into a very interesting time here within our own nation. And I think anyone worth their salt can weigh that, because the election is going to be a very contested election either way it goes.
Right.
And I think given the stunts that have been facilitated throughout our past administration, you know, everything from going on and up in your neck of the woods in Seattle and Oregon and everything up there with, you know, the riots and everything that's going on. I think that we need to keep our heads on a swivel. And it's just one of those things in life that I think we need to just remain at the ready to see what unfolds.
Yeah.
Because I think we're on the cusp of some significant changes here. I think cards will be shown. They'll be put out on the table, and there will be a new awakening in this nation. And with that awakening, depending on people's level of hubris and compassion and understanding for the other side, things could get shitty real quick.
Yeah, they could.
Okay, well, you got Southern Command down here. So if things get hot up there in the Northwest and you need a place to fall back to,
all right.
You got the Everglades, and the Everglades are still as hard as shit to get through as anywhere else. So it's always a good place to fall back and regroup.
I might have to take that up, man.
All right.
So remember, folks, it takes a team. The grass is not always greener on the other side. Be careful what you wish for, because you might just get it. And until next time, keep it real.
Okonis the Contractor's Life extends a special thank you to music composer Kava Cohen and to Colin Perry of Ninja Tracks for allowing Okonis the Contractor's Life the use of Kava's song, Heavy Clutch, from the music soundtrack to the game Forza Motorsport 7. And also a big thank you to Andres Rodriguez, who can be found at the Fiverr website, for his excellent original music scores.